Ben Smith, I'm a photographer, and this is my podcast, A Small Voice, Conversations with Photographers. Thanks for listening. Hi folks, welcome to episode 27 of the podcast. Before this week's guest, I thought we'd do a little rundown of things that might be of interest to you. The PDN Photo Annual Award winners were announced a couple of weeks ago, so you can see the winning entries from that at pdnannual.com. Congratulations to all those people. A couple of other prizes. The annual Nigering House Courage in Photojournalism Award has been won by Adrienne Ohanesian for her, quote, tenacious dedication, unquote, to her work in Sudan over the past 6 years or so. And the Tim Hetherington Trust Visionary Award has been won by Dominic Bracco for his work from Mexico. So congratulations to both of them. Apologies for any dodgy pronunciation of names. I thought I'd mention a couple of Kickstarter campaigns. The first is from Kai Weidenhofer, who a lot of you might know from his long-term documentary work on the Palestine-occupied territories. And his project is called War on Wall. And he's looking to fund an exhibition of his work on Syrians wounded by the war and the cities there that have been destroyed. And the idea is to exhibit these images on the last remaining section of the Berlin Wall. Apparently there is still a last remaining section of the Berlin Wall, to raise awareness for Syrian refugees. So have a look at that one on Kickstarter. The other campaign is by this week's guest, Ed Thompson, who is currently trying to raise funds for his forthcoming book, The Unseen, which we talk about in the interview. So there'll be a link in the notes on the website. But Ed's website is edwardthompson.co.uk, and you can get to the Kickstarter campaign from there. So have a look at that one as well. There's also an open call for the Organ Vida Festival, which is in Zagreb in Croatia. Great little festival. I went there a few years ago. And that happens in mid-September of this year. And their theme this year is Revelations. The deadline for that is very, very soon, the 20th of May. So, you know, you haven't got long if you want to get something into there on the theme of Revelations. Famous Magnum photographer Steve McCurry is the subject of considerable controversy after some fairly extreme image manipulation of his work came to light and sparked a bit of a social media shitstorm. So, you know, if you don't know about that and you're interested in finding out more about that, just Google it. There have been a number of quite interesting responses on that issue already. Here in London, the people behind Miniclick Photo Talks are running the School of Miniclick from Friday, June 17th to Sunday 19th at the Photographer's Gallery. And there'll be a series of talks, workshops, fun and games from a wide range of guest teachers. So that sounds good. Check that out at miniclick.co.uk if you are UK-based. Finally, as I mentioned last time, Photo London has begun at Somerset House. That runs from the 19th to 22nd of May. I'll be nosing around down there on behalf of this very podcast. It's just come to my attention that if you want to go there, regardless of what you want to see or do once you're there, you are required to pay for a day pass at the cost of £27. And in addition, as far as I can gather, if you also want to attend any of the talks or screenings, you have to pay an additional £13 on top of that. So that means the cost of watching a film or hearing one of your sort of photographers that you admire bang on about their work or impart useful wisdom to you is £40. So, you know, if that's correct, then that's an absolute fucking disgrace in my view, to be absolutely honest. Sorry about the language, but, you know, seriously, how is that an acceptable amount of money to charge? So my guest this week, Ed Thompson. Ed is a British photographer, artist and lecturer. His own photographic work has focused on various subjects over the years, from covering environmental issues, socio-political movements, subcultures and the consequences of war, and his documentary photo essays have been published in international magazines including National Geographic, Newsweek Japan and The Guardian Weekend magazine. In 2007 he studied a master's degree in photojournalism and documentary photography at the London College of Communication, for which he received first class distinction. And in 2013, Ed started Punctum, which evolved into the School of Punctum, where leading photographers and lecturers from various London universities teach month-long courses on documentary photography to intimate 10-person classes from as little as £100. And there are also free portfolio reviews. It's a brilliant idea. Ed explains in the interview how it came about, and you can find out more at schoolofpunctum.wordpress.com. So that's Punctum spelt P-U-N-K-T-U-M, schoolofpunctum.wordpress.com. On his website, Ed describes himself as a documentary photographer, lecturer and raconteur. And it's true, he is a great talker. He's a very engaging interviewee. He's opinionated and uncompromising in his views. He's funny. He's a bit sweary, but he's extremely articulate. And above all, he's passionate about photography. So I really enjoyed chatting to him, and I hope you enjoy listening to it. Here's Ed. Like I say, I feel underprepared here.
Don't worry, man. I think we'll get through it.
I'm confident. The one thing I have established is that you will be talking a little bit. So that helps, definitely.
Pretend we're on like Radio 6 Music and it's like 2 in the morning. Fine.
I would. Okay. I'd probably be very sleepy in that situation. Where should we start? You've got quite a lot of things going on, actually.
Yeah.
You've got a show at the Barge House.
Yep, there's an exhibition that's going to be at the Barge House,
On the river.
On the river, by the Oxo Tower.
Okay.
Yeah.
And that's a kind of group thing, which is happening roughly the same time as Photo London.
About the same time as Photo
probably
London.
Probably not such a good thing in terms of timing.
There's hopes there's going to be footfall, because the exhibition venue's only 30 minutes walk from Somerset House.
Okay.
So there will be, I've been told there'll be lots of people coming 30 minutes away.
I suppose you just go over the bridge.
Yeah, it's quite accessible.
And then onto the river.
Yeah. Public transport is very good to the location.
Yeah. All right. Now, the work is that's there is your current sort of project, which, or your kind of main preoccupation at the moment, which is Unseen.
Yeah.
And you are in the process of doing a Kickstarter.
Yeah.
Which we'll talk about. That does seem to have become sort of default option now, as far as funding a book goes. So it's always nice to kind of hear about people's experience of doing that. Also, because you do quite a lot of lecturing and teaching. I've decided that you must be some kind of an expert on these things. Maybe that's not true.
I have lectured on crowdfunding a lot.
Okay.
It's one of the things even in 2007, what am I talking about? It wasn't 2007 at all. But maybe for the sake, we'll say it's 2007.
Doesn't matter.
No, I've lectured a number of times, like maybe 6 or 7 times, just on crowdfunding and self-publishing itself.
Okay, cool.
Because back when I photographed Occupy London in 2011,
yeah,
there we go. I crowdfunded and self-published a book on Occupy London, and that was done through Indiegogo,
right?
Which was an independent website, very different to Kickstarter. It was started by a guy who did it a lot for medical stuff in America.
Okay.
And Slavo Rubin, the CEO, he was a very nice guy, man. His father, I think, died of cancer, and he was trying to work out ways for Americans to kind of get money for bills, hospital bills and stuff. So yeah. I went with them originally for that one.
Right.
Whereas this time around, I've gone Kickstarter purely because, you know, it's Kickstarter, it's the one to go to, I guess.
Yeah.
But what's interesting of Kickstarter is they like certain projects.
Right.
And they haven't liked mine.
So you kind of get,
yeah,
if they choose it,
well,
more people
get
to see.
Here's the thing that's funny, right? About it's really about SEO in a way. Do you know what I mean? Like an optimization here. If you go on Google now and type in documentary photographer, it's the Wikipedia definition, number one, and then my website. And some days I beat Wikipedia.
No.
Now here's the deal. People who get caught up about the profile on a crowdfunding website seem to live in some la-la land where they imagine that people go through crowdfunding websites just browsing.
Mm.
Maybe some do, but the majority of people I imagine will go for a crowdfunding website for a link. I've already looked at my analytics for the 3,000 I've raised so far. Like 1,500 has just come from Facebook, from people seeing links, about 600 from Twitter. Some direct links, and literally only 300 has come through people looking on Kickstarter.
Right.
And
I mean, that makes sense. And I'm quite surprised it's that many.
Yeah.
Because, like you say, the whole point of Kickstarter surely is that, you know, you're reaching out to your own network.
Yeah.
The network that you've already established via other social media, and you're just saying, look, heads up, here's the thing. Like you say, it's quite amazing to think that people are actually browsing through thinking, now what can I, what can I, you know, put my money into?
But the good thing about all this is I have a wonderful sense of humour. And the fact that there's a book currently liked on Kickstarter, which is a photo book of dogs eating peanut butter.
Right.
So that's important work, and I'm glad that they're getting the attention.
There's a lot of dog people out there.
There are a lot of dog people. My book covers kind of climate change, colonial history, flooding, pollution, disease, you know, just light-hearted stuff. So I can see why people want to dogs have peanut butter.
Dogs are peanut butters.
Yeah, I'd buy it. I'd get on it.
There's more to it. But it's a bit like that, you know, the most popular Instagram picture of all time is that woman lying down with her hair kind of. Have you seen that?
No. It'll just say Instagram.
Instagram.
I'm not actually on Instagram. Okay. I don't go
but
on
But it's
it.
The most viewed Instagram or the most liked or whatever Instagram image of all time. It's like, and there's got to be a bazillion of them. Yeah. And it's just shit in every possible way.
You know, EastEnders is really popular.
Yeah, no, well, then we're into it.
And, and I hear the music of the... I was trying to drop a contemporary cultural music reference. I was going to say Pussycat Dolls, but I think I'm about 10 years out of date. I just don't know.
Is EastEnders still on?
I don't even know.
That's been on since I was young, and that's a freaking long time
ago. I had always a nightmare when I was younger that the only thing that would exist up to the apocalypse would be like cockroaches and EastEnders, and that on the last week, EastEnders would still be being put out on television.
It reminds me of a quote by, who's the guy who did Star Trek?
J.J. Abrams?
No, that's Star
Wars.
Oh, the
original, Gene Roddenberry. I thought you meant the reboot.
No.
I'm a Star Trek fan. I grew up in Next Generation.
There you go. Yeah. So that's the kind of appropriate reference.
That's one thing I should say. That's why I'm wearing a Star Trek uniform now.
Yes.
For this interview.
The full Stormtrooper outfit, which you didn't have to... Star Trek.
Oh, shit, yeah. It's the red uniform because I've modelled my beard on Will Riker.
See, I've totally ruined the gag there now. You're going to have to do it again.
I'm actually wearing a wife beater right now.
Now, that is true.
Yeah. And also, you've been drawing strange occult symbols on the piece of paper. Like, that looks like a goat. I just want to say that looks like a goat.
If you were wearing the Stormtrooper outfit, my kid would be... Yeah. You'd be in his good books immediately. Yeah. What I was going to say about Gene Roddenberry was that he said, quite rightly, people say that, you know, 90% of television is crap, but 90% of everything is crap.
Yeah.
You know, and that's worth bearing in mind. So, moving swiftly along... tell me about The Unseen.
It was a kind of a long form, multiple part series, using some of the last rolls of current thread film ever made. When I was a little kid, my family moved to Kent and I had an Osborne Book of Ghosts. And in that Book of Ghosts, it had a double page spread about the most haunted village in the world.
Uh-huh.
And that happened to be Pluckley in Kent, which was like 10 miles from where we'd moved to. So being a little kid, obsessed with like that kind of stuff, managed to go on like a weekend with my mum and dad, a little day trip. I took my little camera, my 110mm Cobra camera, and a little thermometer to monitor temperature variations, you know. I was really invested in it. And nothing happened. No. I failed. I failed abysmally.
No ghosts.
And then I grew up and I had a career as a photojournalist and doing lots of work and lots of like projects on like everyday uncanny stuff. But at the back of my mind as an idea was always Pluckley. Because there's something interesting there, you know, about the idea of a haunted village.
Mm.
It fits into this weird, very English Wicker Man kind of vibe.
Mm.
It's also kind of challenging because in the beginning, I always picked very visually charged subjects to photograph. You know, make it easy on yourself.
Mm.
Right? If it's visually charged, it's easier to shoot. Whereas suddenly now it's like, okay, how do you inherently photograph something that's not visible? And there's ways around this. If you look at work, say, like Joel Sternfeld's On This Site, where you show landscape photographs and you like sort of, it looks really innocuous, this seat at the cinema. But then you write the caption, this is where, you know, Lee Harvey Oswald was arrested in the cinema here.
Yeah.
And it suddenly changes the read of the image. So at first I thought I could go to this haunted village and shoot this kind of very much kind of presence of absence kind of series, working on this kind of site-specific idea of the history of this sort of psychogeography of the land. And then I thought, fuck it, I'll just try and shoot ghosts, you know?
Mm.
No, I found some research online and I started looking into like spirit photography, which started like, you know, phantasmagoria, weird seance kind of shit. And what was interesting is I found that infrared was used to debunk mediums back then. They'd use infrared to kind of cut light through the darkness of a seance to show the medium tipping the chair or moving the table.
Yeah.
Whereas in the modern age, infrared's still being used, but it was trying to be used to show ghosts exist. So ghost hunters were using it. So cue me going to the haunted village of Pluckley, walking around, taking some shots, and lo and behold, the work, it was really fucking wild.
Mm.
Like the aesthetic was so surreal. I've done little talks at like secondary schools and like colleges and even primary schools with this stuff. And even kids look at it before I say anything, they're like, wow, it's, you know, it's kind of dark, or it's kind of foreboding.
Mm.
And that's this really cool thing as well, because this is this link between like knowledge and perception. Like one of the photos is of this bush. It's just this weird red bush, but it's the devil's bush. And allegedly, if you dance around it 3 times counterclockwise at midnight, you'll summon Lucifer.
Mm.
And you bear that in mind, and then you relook at the photo. It takes the viewer somewhere else.
Yeah,
you
know? Totally.
So from that, I was like, this is awesome. I need to look into this film. I then found the original Kodak kind of advertisements listing lots of different uses in land management, geology, forestry, flooding, risk management, whatever. And then bit by bit, to cut a long story short, British Library, lots of crazy old scientific books, forgotten stuff. And that's what The Unseen is. It's like this weird odyssey to this sort of dead stock film.
Yeah.
Which all of the things are linked by this unseen element, the unseen ghosts, the unseen radiation of Chernobyl, the kind of marginalized in the media, unseen kind of flood refugees who aren't reported on, sort of colonial history, the invisible pollution, the astrophotography, which is cutting through nebulas, which obviously we can't see. But really also bound up by the fact that the whole book, it's, I don't want to spoil it too much, but it's something else, man. You know, this is not a coffee table fine art photo book. This has gone somewhere else. I think the book design, thanks to Tim van der Heijden, who's a great designer, working with him, we've created something that kind of exists in its own little world, like the work, you know.
I mean, I guess I should probably, at this stage, just briefly say, in case people are not, you know, au fait with the work, and they should go and look at it, you know, if they're listening to this, they should go and look at it on your website, which is edthompson.co.uk.
Yeah, there's not actually much on the website.
It's had a fair amount of play, so there's quite a lot of stuff out
there. Yeah, there's stuff on the BBC and Vice and other bits, but that's the earliest stuff.
But basically what it means is that all the greens go red, effectively, and some of the other tones aren't affected at all.
Sometimes they are, sometimes they aren't.
Yeah.
It's a bit weird. Like, for instance, I photograph paintings because infrared film was used to see underdrawing, which is when people make charcoal sketches, but it's also used in paintings to see manipulations if people had, like, doctored or modified the painting. And, for instance, there the colour shifts change because the colour green of a pigment is different to the colour green represented by the way chlorophyll reflects infrared light. Right. We can get in some real technical shit right now, but the point is that I've had some cool help along the way, some really cool people, very knowledgeable on this kind of stuff. And what's really cool is I had one of them proofread, just checking the tech for my book and like almost like what I've researched or whatever. And I was waiting for this guy to come back and be like, oh, this is wrong, this is wrong. He was not only like, this is all really good. He was asking me like, where do you find information about this?
Wow.
And I think that's one thing about being a documentary photographer. People, I think students, I don't know what they think, like maybe a magazine comes and they give you all this research and you spend all this time doing it. You don't. A magazine gives you an assignment. It's like a day. At the best, it's 3 days. And they've done a little bit of research. When you're doing your own work, man, no one ruminates like a dork. Do you know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
I can seriously get into it here. And that's one of the fascinating things for me about research is that I've had moments, I think we all have moments as photographers, where we take an image which somehow exists outside of the other images we've taken, like in the same moment, whether some people call it the decisive moment, other people see it as an act of almost like Jungian synchronicity, something has gone on, right? That happens in the research too. And for me, it's like that moment where the detective puts the glass down on the table and he looks over it doing his braces like in Who Framed Roger Rabbit, and then he sees it and the penny drops. When I was researching forests for the Unseen, I had to pick a forest to photograph, you know, to try and have a bash emulating this kind of scientific use. And then I found out about Wormwood Forest, which was a forest next to Chernobyl, the reactor, which blew up. It was doused in so much radiation that it died, but before it died, it turned bright red. And to this day, it's not called Wormwood Forest, it's called the Red Forest. And that's why I photographed there.
Yeah, wow, interesting.
And also infrared film is used in forestry to see the health of plants. So it's just, once again, it's double whammy kind of narratives. There's lots of stuff going on because, yes, the trees are red again, which then also has this link to kind of like Russian Soviet Burgundy. It's psychogeographical, but at the same time, it's technical because I'm showing you how healthy the trees are. And the weird thing is the radioactive trees, man, they're doing all right.
Yeah.
You know?
So when, did it, or how did it go from just your initial visit to the haunted village to something which you could see that was, could become a much wider project?
It went very slowly because at first I didn't really have any film. I mean, it was dead stock. It was very hard to get hold of. I mean, I started in 2010. At this point, I'm still photographing Occupy London, the last book I crowdfunded, and the English Defence League, as well as doing hundreds of assignments.
Mm.
And in the time of, the last 6 years, I photographed the Syrian refugees in Lebanon series. I've done lots of other projects and assignments and teaching. So it's weird. Like, one of the things I teach my students is your limitations are your strength.
Mm.
And some kids come up to me and they want to be like a great street photographer, but they're a little bit timid. And they feel bad about if they misrepresent someone. And I say to them, then don't do it, man. Like, have a go, but maybe there's another way to do this. You should go with who you are,
Yeah.
Don't try and be who you're not. And I think that's one thing that comes through with, trying to make a stab at something. It's like my limitations were, for me, it was a really big deal trying to do those aerial photos of London. Was just trying to get enough money to do the helicopter.
Mm.
That took me years,
right,
to save up enough.
Right.
Whereas if I'd, the whole book really, it was only shot on 52 rolls of film.
Yeah, that is
even
quite amazing.
It took 6 years, and that's one thing. My limitation, which was me having to wait to get stuff in place, it was great because while I was waiting, I was researching and I was thinking. And if I just hit the film and shot it all straight away, it could have just been one thing, whereas I've stretched like a 13-part series from radioactive photos of the Northern Lights to inside glaciers to flooded refugee camps in India to aerial shots of London to nude medical photos. Once again, it's
very wide-ranging, and it's the way that you've basically used the infrared thing as a kind of jumping off point, but to explore a whole bunch of other kind of themes and subjects. But and also you found out at some point that there wasn't hardly any of this film still around.
Well, even when I started, it was discontinued to the point where every role I used was handmade.
Wow. So to what extent was that fact kind of part of your decision to make a kind of project out of it? Was that kind of quite a major driver, or was that just something you had to, a kind of restriction that you had to make a virtue out of?
It was just one of those things where we all have it throughout photographic history. When things become discontinued, photographers get very interested, and it's like someone saying to you, you won't be able to use this camera anymore, you won't be able to use this film stock anymore. Of course you want to have a go. I just think it's insane that I've managed to stretch 52 rolls into my first internationally kind of published book,
yeah,
which is kind of mental, considering other photographers, they probably shoot shitloads. But
yeah,
my one saving grace being an editorial photographer who'd done a lot of assignment, especially shooting medium format, or even my own projects on medium format, I never really had much film to play with, man. A whole of my Rehome series, the chicken series that was in National Geographic magazine, Sunday Times, or blah, 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 that was shot in 20 rolls of medium format. You know what I mean? That's like 240 shots, and that was enough for an edit. And I think,
I mean, people often, say, when you shoot in medium format, it's a different thing to, 35 mil, you have to slow down, you have to be more considered, which is all true. And obviously, in your case, you absolutely had to do that because you had a very major limitation on how much you had, but how much film you had. But have you taken anything from that in terms of what it's taught you about being considered?
Yeah, it's very different. If you look at how I shot the English Defence League, I was like rocking around with protests. I mean, I never use a tripod for a start. None of the unseen was on a tripod, man. Like the whole thing, Mamiya RZ67, I'm just throwing it around. Like there's a video of me in the start of the Kickstarter in Chernobyl holding the camera in the air. That's something I've always done since hanging out with Sergei Chilikov, this Russian photographer who I kind of crashed on his floor for a few years when I was younger. And I saw him doing that all those years back. And it's something that I've always done because you know what? You're shooting a landscape with medium format or anything, man. You get higher, it's more interesting. You see more to the horizon.
Yeah.
So that's something I've always done.
Yeah.
There we go.
So you're trying to raise $5,000.
Yeah.
And it's going to be published by Schilt, is that right?
Yeah. And Schilt's good because, I'm working with Tim van der Heijden, who's this amazing designer, man. He's just fucking awesome.
Does he kind of come along with the publisher, as it were?
He works for pretty much everyone. He's a freelancer, but yeah, he's based in Holland as well. So it was a good fit. I've got some friends in Holland who I stay with. Friends, so it just the whole thing is just, it was very easy to sort of go to Amsterdam and hang out with the publisher and then also work with the designer. But the main thing as well was Schilt. They got great distribution. They distribute globally with Thames and Hudson. So it just made sense for this. It's quite a big run. It's 1500 copies, which is pretty it's a lot going on.
Yeah.
So that's kind of cool.
So $5,000 for 1,500 copies is pretty frugal.
No, that's not it.
I mean, that's not going to cover it. I mean, no, but it's you're not looking for the full amount kind of thing.
No, not at all. Well, the Arts Council picked up a chunk and the publisher puts in some as well.
Yeah.
So the whole thing, the way it levels out, you just have to imagine like they've got to sell copies. And the hard thing for publishers is that the minute it goes in a bookshop, that's half the money gone.
Yeah, exactly.
Whereas everything like on Kickstarter, I'm selling my copies.
Yeah.
So there we go.
Yeah.
You know?
No, that makes perfect sense.
Yeah.
So let's go back to the beginning. So, you know, yeah, it's funny how that experience of going to that village at 8 sort of stayed with you.
Are we getting like creation myth here? Can I tell you how I got these scars?
Yeah, go on, please do. How'd you get that one, that really huge one?
Yeah. I was talking about the ones on each side of my mouth. Oh, I was going to get all joke on you. No, okay, here's a good creation myth. I like this one. I've got lots of weird stories I tell about how I got into photography, and I'll just tell you one now. I'm pretty sure it's true, and I'm not sure if it's the deciding factor, but it makes a good story.
I believe you.
There was a girl that I really fancied when I was 13, and she was like the world's second test tube baby, and she was super religious, like super Christian. I think maybe because she felt weird about being a test tube baby, whatever. But
it's good so far.
I was super nihilistic, Nietzsche reading, kind of little young sort of stonery kid. So that was weird. That was kind of weird going on. But what I do know is that when I had my brother's Pentax K1000, the cool kind of vintagey strap that he obviously got when he was photographing, studying in Alabama, she thought that was kind of cool. So you know what I did? I used to take the camera out, you know?
Mm.
And the weird thing is I never actually photographed her.
Mm.
You think I would have, right? You think I'd be the kind of guy that would do the whole kind of blow up kind of bullshit thing, but I never did. It was always, I always kind of, you know, first loves, I held her so high on a pedestal in the same way I held photography in too high regard. I never did it.
Mm.
But she liked it when I posed my camera. Yeah. And here's the trick is that I just did that for 20 years. And the weird thing is that you can be anything you want to in this life. And if you do it for long enough, you will be. You just want to make sure that's what you really want.
Yeah. So it was to impress a girl, basically.
Not kind of, but ultimately that it didn't matter because by the time I started to study and I'd had some breaks and like I suddenly was like, ow, I'm actually quite good at this.
Mm.
And I was getting some exhibitions and other sort of accolades early on that obviously kept me going. But I like that initial thing was like the poser thing, which for me to this day, which is why it's funny, is it's awkward for me sometimes to go to say private views or whatever, because there's this weird split between kind of very green, kind of sycophantic people. And then on the other hand, like egomaniacs, and it's a bit weird because they're both kind of wrong, you know? And for the posers, like I recognize them like looking in an old dirty mirror because that was me.
Mm.
But that's not a bad thing. That's just in a way, maybe, or maybe, I don't know, maybe that wasn't true, but it makes a good story.
Yeah. I like it.
Yeah.
So then you did a degree?
Yeah. I was photographing a fair bit and I had to put a portfolio together to get on the course. I was working in a suit shop. So I was working retail, which I think was really good for me going into the degree because, you know, I was already had a little flat trying to pay rent and do shit. And a lot of kids coming onto the course were, I don't think they valued the cost of the experience.
Right. So you're trying to get the most out of it. Kind of.
Yeah. Whereas I was hitting it like very seriously, like wanting to do well. And I had a bit of a break. Some work I shot in the first year was chosen to be part of a group show of some students from the L'École Nationale de la Photographie, which is the Arles Photo Festival.
Yeah.
So off I went to that. I'm like 20.
Wow.
And I'm sort of hanging out with lots of very famous photographers. And it seems really cool.
But you did it. It was a fine art degree and you were really already into documentary at that point.
I wasn't, funny enough. In the beginning, I was just experimenting like hell, man. I was into Dwayne Michaels and narrative. So I was doing weird photos of me running around abandoned cement factories and motion blur. I did weird like cyanotype photos of like sort of layering up different old paintings with then other things. I was doing mixed media. But what happened was is that there was a lecture coming up, another lecture on Cindy Sherman. And in the media, there'd been all this build-up to the May Day protests of 2001. It was all over the news, like, oh, samurai sword-wielding psychopaths, May Day. Oh, police have been authorized maybe to use rubber bullets. And at that point, my friend Stuart had a little Fiesta. I didn't have a car at that point, and I was like, dude, we've got to go to London. So we sacked off college in Maidstone. We hopped in the car and we went right into the thick of it. And I did, you know, these amazing weird photos of like people holding babies and people dressed as pixies. And I was like, what's going on? Like the media was like samurai sword wielding anarchists, and I'm like seeing kids and families. What's going on? It's like the government and the media are colluding on a different narrative that isn't based on reality.
Yeah.
So, and then at that point I was like, okay, so something's going on here. Also, emotion, running down Oxford Street, pissing rain, old leather jacket, Pentax K1000, like reacting quick speed. One of my assets is my speed. I think that's one thing to have as a photographer. Yes, I shoot medium format and it's slower, but I'm so fucking quick, man. I need to slow down. So it's kind of cool in that way, but I'm still shooting it, you know, very on the fly. But yeah, and at that point it was the end of the YBAs, it was the end of the 90s. Lots of universities were teaching students to take photos of people looking bored, staring into the middle distance. That was 20 years ago and it's still going on. But anyway, suddenly being in like this weird real environment, oh my god, it was like, you know, my soul was on fire. Like it was, you know, not like I'm being an adrenaline dickhead or anything. I'm just talking about people having passion and being in the position to do something for a reason, having something to stand for, having something to say. So many photographers now, they do work and they're like, I want to raise questions rather than answers. Thank you. That's it. Goodbye. Whereas I'm like, no, you know what? I feel really passionately about a lot of the stuff I photographed.
Yeah. Was it the photography so much? Was it doing the photography or was it, you know, just seeing people who were sort of politically engaged?
Yeah. I'd always
been... Or was it both?
Yeah, I think it was both. My mum was always big on animal rights. So I was a vegetarian at the time and I'd been to protests and that kind of stuff doing that thing. But this was an anti-capitalist protest. It was very different and, you know, but it was good.
Mm. So you had this thing at Arles quite early on. Oh, well, very early on, your first year of college. That's quite unusual. And then was it Sergei Chilikov?
Yeah.
Tell me about Sergei Chilikov.
So there was.
I don't know who he is, but
he's got a show at Photo London. Funny enough,
has he?
Yeah,
awesome.
And I met him when he was showing at the Arles Festival. And basically, yeah, he's this weird bearded dude who lectures like on philosophy. He's like lives in a funny village called Yoshka Ola, and he was part of like a photo group collective of people like the Magnum guy Pinkasov and then Boris Mikhailov. And basically the whole point of their stories was they were in like Soviet Russia and it was all like, you know, strong picture, take strong picture. But they were like shooting everyday life.
Mm.
And that was a rebellious act then, you know. And he's a weird dude, man. He like thinks other worlds exist, whatever.
Mm.
And what's funny is that, I met him at a private view for Martin Parr, was showing work from holiday camps by this other photographer. It was something like some tagline, like, we are here for your pleasure. Anyway, ironically, like years later, I would end up being a holiday camp photographer.
Right.
But at the time, I didn't know that. But what I did know was that I liked to dance, and there was a DJ called DJ Rebel. And because it was like a Martin Parr private view and everyone was really stuffy, no one was dancing. So I started doing a little bit of like jungly trip up to this DJ dancing. And next thing I know, is this huge dude with a big beard stomping next to me. And it was like Sergei Chilikov, and he'd never heard like trance or jungle music before. So here we are dancing away. And thanks to like this like gay guy from Russian MTV, we kind of got chatting and like we couldn't speak to each other because I couldn't speak fucking Russian. He couldn't speak English. And then I ended up going to stay at his weird, he had some like weird residency at some tower block in Paris.
Mm.
And like I was invited along.
Was he living there?
Well, only, you know, for a couple of weeks.
Oh, right.
So yeah. Long story really short, I end up in Paris, I'm sleeping on this like marble floor, he's sleeping on the floor, but he's got like a laptop and he's playing like weird pinball game. We don't really eat, we just drink loads of wine and photograph all day.
Mm.
And then we develop the photos because it's like pre-digital, and then he looks at my photos and he'd be like, good, no, Russian photo. And the only thing he'd say for me was go for a walk. So we'd go for a walk. And then through him, I met the Magnum guy, Pinkasov, and I was in like the Magnum offices in France after hours, and we're flicking through photos, and it was just amazing.
That's that sounds like a really lovely kind of fantasy apprenticeship in a way.
But it wasn't as well, because like I never spoke to him since.
Right.
No contact or whatever. But just in that short little encounter, man. Like,
what did you learn?
I'll never forget. It was like, you know, Chilikov's fucking nuts, right? And I'm kind of wacky, man. And it made sense to have some guy who's like a professor of like kind of crazy metaphysical shit being my kind of psychopomp.
Mm.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, it is. He was an appropriate person for you to have randomly hooked up with.
But
or maybe not so
time,
random.
Through him, just that short conversation with Pinkasov in the offices after hour. And And he just, I'll never forget this. I was just chatting to him and he just showed me some work and we were looking at slides. And he just said, you know, photography, it's really special and it allows me to touch at something great.
Mm.
And that was like, yeah, you know what? I'm on board, man. I'm on board. And since then, like, you know, utmost respect for photography, utmost respect for photographers. Like, things have changed a lot, but we can do amazing things. We can share amazing stories. And stories will always be told. There's always room for narrative. And, you know, we tell stories.
Hmm. See, this is a problem when I'm not, when I haven't got questions in front of me. We have these little moments of me going, what the
Well, look, man, look, I can really interject something here.
No, it's cool.
Well, okay, so,
There's so much to graduation,
right? So, boom. So, like, keeping the holiday camp theme, like, I've done this 3-year degree. It's very fine art. And you're built up to be, like, these fine art little machines. And you think it's all good. And you're going to have the exhibition at Brick Lane. And Saatchi's going to come in and buy the work and whatever. None of it happens. Then you get down the job centre. And you realise, like, apart from HGV driver or nursing, like, there's nothing you can do. And there was a job at holiday camp. And that's when I started working at New Beach Holiday Camp, where I was photographing Loopy the Rabbit, doing the Loopy dance, and then children would sit on the knee of the giant Loopy the Rabbit. And, yeah, and I'd have, like, a guy coming up and being like, well, don't know, mate, don't want to pay £5 for that. I'll tell you what, mate, yeah, £3, yeah? And you don't go, but sir, I have exhibited an aisle. You go, yes, sir, that's great, thank you.
Mm.
Because that's the difference. It's like... It's weird, like I really, really was taught value, like the real value of photography in different ways, which then led me to doing lots of different work, freelancing, but always trying to work on my own stories.
Yeah.
You know, the very first photo essay I did was near where I lived. It was a miniature steam railway. And here's the method in my madness for that. So I'm learning. I'm all about this weird moment and trying to be in the right place or work out what to do. You know, where do I need to stand? What's going to happen? How do I gauge a moment? Because that's the thing with photography, especially documentary. If you see the moment, you've missed it.
Mm.
As the mirror flies up, man, like, unless it's a rangefinder, you're not really seeing the moment. It's almost like an act of kind of precognition.
Mm.
So I decided to shoot the miniature steam railway because I thought if the train comes in and I fuck up, if I wait 20 minutes, I get another go.
Right, yeah.
And as I'm stood at the train platform... I start seeing there's some old boys with like little Polaroid cameras, all wonky looking old dudes, you know. They're miniature train spotter photographers. So here I am, you know, with all these like miniature train spotter photographers doing portraits of them. And I'm having them hold their photos up and I'm grinning to myself thinking, oh, these fucking, you know, these weirdos, you know, what weirdos these people are. Then as the train pulled out, I looked around the platform and there are all these old boys with their silly old cameras. And there's me with my Bronica SQA and I realized, yeah, I'm one of the weirdos, yeah? And I think that's something to touch on here as well, is that a lot of my earlier work, there's a lot of humour. And I said something to you briefly about the idea of, like, the fool, of being the fool.
Mm.
And in the beginning, yeah, I think I fell into that kind of jokey sort of seaside postcard documentary photographer aesthetic a little bit. But then stuff changed and... You know, I think we can do more with photography than take the piss out of people, basically. And I think sometimes some photographers, I don't know, we live in a very weird age where they could have got away with it in the 60s and 70s because no one would have seen their work. Whereas now of the internet, if you go walking down the street and you snap a shot of some old woman looking scared because you're jamming a camera in her face and flashing it, she could find out about that. Man, her son or daughter could see that and be like, man, you really scared the shit out of my granny.
Yeah.
And, you know, this is also one thing to touch on with teaching as well, is ideas of informed consent. Like, when I was photographing a series on Syrian refugees in Lebanon, it was like trying to kind of make sure that everyone understood, can I take your portrait? This is where it's going. Do you want to give an interview? And the hard thing was the independent. They didn't get their head around when I was trying to show them the work that some people wanted to be photographed and not speak. Some people would speak and not be photographed. And like they couldn't understand that because, you know, you have to have a photo of an interview. And it's like informed consent now has gone from that to like a constant thing. Even the Nuclear Family series I shot at Dungeness, when that work came out online on The Guardian, some people were mocking the weight of some of the women in it who were pregnant. Writing shitty comments.
What people? Oh, people, you know, just, you know, like
twerps commenting on the fucking Guardian.
Right, right. Yeah.
Just taking the piss out of these people. And it's like...
Yeah. I mean, I've said it before, but, you know, looking through the comment section of the Guardian, it does not kind of leave you with a particularly rosy view of human nature. At times, anyway. Yeah. I mean,
it's just one of my things, and I've said this before about assignments. Like, I'm really good at, like, over the years, just embedding in, like, all kinds of crazy situations. Kind of, I'm a weird kind of dude, and I find, like, there's a subculture or a group or whatever. I don't really have to integrate. I just create a new paradigm, which is that group plus Ed.
Mm.
And it always generally works. Now, let's say an assignment comes up, and it's on childhood obesity, and the magazine sends me off, and I meet this lovely family, and I talk to this little 9-year-old girl, and it's all lovely, and everyone likes me, because, you know, so fucking charming.
What's not to like?
Modest, and, you know, I'm wearing a dinner jacket right now as well. I mean, I don't generally wear the bow tie when I photograph, but I think it's good to overdress.
You changed out of the wife beater.
Yeah, I'm on the dinner jacket now. But anyway, long story short, too late. What if that magazine then comes out on the Saturday, and the front cover is this little girl, and it just says, you know, obese kids, and then she goes to school the next day and is bullied to fuck, and it really fucks her life up. Like, it's weird. Like, I am... Yeah, I've done interviews on the World Service and Al Jazeera about ethics in photography, and it's just really difficult. It's really, you know... That's the thing, is that's my shit, okay? Other people have no fucking problem, and that's fine.
Mm.
But for me, that's my weakness.
But
I found a way of making that one of my strengths, and I think it's the same with all of us, man. We've all got stuff, lines we're not willing to cross.
Well, you mean caring about this shit is your... Yeah. And yeah, I presume you kind of try and impart this to your students.
But at the same time, like, they don't. Some don't. And that's fine. You know, you got to do what you got to do. But
so, you know, going back to this thing of kind of, you know, it is incredibly easy to make someone look stupid or ugly.
Yeah.
And a lot of photographers, Bruce Gilden obviously comes to mind because he's made a career out of that kind of style. How do you feel about that kind of stuff?
Well, that's what he wants to do. I mean, you know, we get down to it, man. Like, I do a really big, long lecture on the ethics in photography, and I cover everything from, like, the way people use or do stuff with their subject through to manipulation or whatever. And, you know, the things that you do, you got to live with them.
Mm.
And some people are totally fine. Other photographers over the years, famously, lots of suicides, like, they have trouble going on because you see some crazy shit.
Yeah,
and that was also an interesting thing as a student. I had loads of James Nachwey stuff in my sketchbooks, you know, when I was doing my BA because I was getting into documentary, and the tutors wouldn't tell us these guys. I'd go to the library and I'd find these books and like teach myself. And
who were your guys at that stage then? Nachwey, who else?
Diane Arbus, man.
Mm.
All about Arbus.
Mm.
Huge. She was the one that, like, yeah, that was it.
I can see that there.
For me, had to be.
Yeah, she sort of catches quite a lot of people's imagination. She's got a very kind of unique thing
going on.
And
I guess at the library as well, it's the kind of book that's around, you know, it made sense when I've seen it.
Yeah, Nachwey, you were saying he had some stuff in it.
Yeah, so anyway, yeah, and like, I had the little revelation years later, being a photographer, which I think a lot of people still don't fucking have, which is kind of weird in the photo industry. You know, photos of real things. I know, like, there'll be a big debate and argument in fine art land because, you know, manipulation of the photographer, cropping the moment or when they choose to take the photo, all this shit. But we can all kind of at least try and agree that an image in, like, photojournalism or documentary is kind of a moment that happened. But yet people forget it's real. I had a friend, he's a great photojournalist, did stuff for the New York Times, and it was a World Press photo a few years back. And he sent me a link to this photo, and it's of Haiti, and it was like a toddler's dead ragdoll body being flying through the air onto a truck with loads of bodies. And he was like, oh man, it's an amazing shot. And I was like, dude, how old's your son? Like, it was weird. And I think we're a bit desensitized. It's not even desensitized. I think people can't connect in their brain. They see so many artificial images. They don't seem to get that.
What do you mean by artificial, though?
Constructed, manipulated, like advertising imagery, fashion imagery, fine art, constructive photography, that kind
of
shit.
And they can't distinguish between that and the real stuff, is that what you mean?
I think on some psychological level, they don't ever make that jump.
Mm.
They don't seem to get it. Like,
yeah, this know? Is a, I mean, also that idea that, you know, if a picture of a little, you know, dead kid getting thrown into the back of a truck is not enough to elicit a really major kind of emotional human response, then what is? Yeah. You know, is are we all just, well, people who do that kind of work, are they just wasting their time? Because there seems to be a lot of people who still have a lot of faith in that world or that kind of documentary approach. People still seem to feel that it, you know, it makes a difference or it helps.
It is good that they do it. And I mean, even myself with the Syrian refugee series, I mean, I did that with no fucking help from a mag, no NGO, no access, no whatever shit. There's just a young guy who wanted to chat, who was a student at where I was studying as an alumni. And off we went, man. We fucking just did it.
Mm.
And like, I didn't need anyone's help. I tried to contact the fucking, like, some of the NGOs saying I've done this. They wouldn't reply back to me. And I got that as a front page article, like feature in the Independent magazine and on the BBC and on the BBC World Service going viral. And like, that was all done on my own, you know, through contacts and just trying to do it. And I would like to do more work like that, but I can't do that kind of stuff without any help. And even one of the charities, I won't name them, but they put like a whole page advert sandwiched between my 8-page feature trying to raise money for Syrian refugee kids. Mm-hmm. And it was like, I contacted them. If they'd come to me, we could have done something together. We could have played ball. But anyway,
right.
Here's my bottom line on this, right? It's really good that they're rich, forceful egos out there doing crazy stuff in photojournalism, like covering conflict, because we do need that. We do need those kinds of people. But, you know, like, I'm the dude who's the holiday camp photographer. Do you know what I mean? Like, I'm, you know, on my life path, I think it's difficult. Like, you can do whatever you want to do, but you just want to make sure that you're genuine.
Mm.
You know, there's a great interview I just read online with Billy Childish. He was an alumni of where I studied at CIAD, and he used to come in and do lectures, which totally alienated all the other tutors because they were buying into this very fine art delusion, whatever, conceptual photography. And he'd just come in and blow them all out the water.
What was his shtick then?
Well, you just do stuff. It's very automatic. It's like, I'm going to make a song. I'm going to make a poem. I'm going to make a painting. I'm going to make. I'm going to create. I'm going to just do. And it was that sort of like, yeah, man, you know, let's just do it kind of vibe that I kind of chimed into. But also it kind of obviously anti-establishment. That's kind of cool, you know, when you're a kid. But I read a great interview of him and he's very positive now and he's still doing great work and it's on his own terms, you know. And that's something I think he was striving to. It was about authenticity. And I think that's something we can all do. And I say this to my students, right? They'll be like, oh, I've had this idea, but someone did something a bit like it, like whenever. And I was like, yeah, but you know what? You didn't.
Yeah.
And I want to see what you do, you know? I want to see what you do. And that's the thing is you're so unique. Like, just not getting too freaky here, but the way your cerebral cortex works, like, you're just seeing dots and lines, man. Your brain is projecting loads of stuff onto it. Our perception is so insanely subjective. If you can tap into that, you've got the monopoly, man, because it's just you.
Mm.
Fantastic.
What do they say when you tell them that? I don't know what you're talking about.
No, they love it, man. They love it. They get
that's great.
They just get fired up and they get fired up to the point where I just want them to like punch a tornado. Do you know what I mean? I want them to kick over a wall and just do it and just be awesome and love it and love it. Because let's face it, like some students, I don't get this because I was so prolific as a student photographing. Some students don't photograph much.
Mm.
Okay. And it's just some people are like that.
Mm.
But when they do go out and photograph, they come back and they show me pictures and there's one that's like, good. I am so on it. Mm. I'm so on them. Like, man, that is an amazing shot. Well done. Oh, you totally killed it.
Yeah.
And then they come back next week with more photos and they're better and they keep going and they just keep getting better. And I think that's a wonderful thing about photography is that when you take a great shot, that's yours. No one can take it away from you and it's yours forever, you know? Mm. So you
emphasise the good stuff and sort of gloss over the fact that all the other pictures were no good or whatever. And
yeah, but it's beginning. That's the way it's beginning. To do it. I mean, that's the thing. An amateur photographs until they take a good photo. When you kick ass, man, you just do it so you can't take a bad one. Like my 52 rolls. How many pictures is that? I basically in the book there's like 150. I can't remember how many photos. Basically, one in five photos I took on that film, or is it one in four? Was in the book.
Was in the book. Yeah. No, I've kind of tried to do the maths.
That's
and that.
Like
I'm not very good at it.
Edit.
Yeah, yeah. That's impressive.
And normally when I shoot medium format film for my series, is like the EDL or the Syrian refugees in Lebanon, living historians, all that stuff. It was one in three.
Mm. Well, tell me about the EDL. That's the English Defence League, which is a sort of one of those far-right groups in this country, in the UK. You did a project on them. How did that
come about? That was my first commission project. And when I say commission, I mean, I did loads of assignments before then. But assignments is like a photo edit going, okay, we've had this idea. There's foragers and they go get mushrooms. And it's really original. Everyone's up getting mushrooms. And you're like, yeah, I've just done two assignments this month for other weekend magazines doing that. But yeah, great idea, guys. Great idea. Then you go off, you shoot fucking foragers. It's wet. The weather's shit. There's no light. And then they're like, oh, it's just foraging. And you're like, yeah, it's fucking foraging. So this was the first time that a group had said, right, project, Dutch organization called Photodoc. It's a Europe-wide project called The Rise of Populism. And each photographer in different European countries is going to pick a way of representing that. They chose me to represent the UK. They paid me some cash. Off I went. I've got to work out how I'm going to cover this. At that exact minute, only around for like 6-7 months, was a group who were currently being called the biggest populist street movement of a generation. And that was the English Defence League.
Mm.
And all the photos that exist online, I mean, this is funny what we're talking about now, because this is like how my mind works when I sort of put a project together. But basically, all the work I found online or to do with the EDL when I was researching them, it was long telephoto lenses by press photographers behind the police, or it was wide angle shots of police arresting the EDL and dragging them out for a cordon. And that was it. So in IROC, I see that they've got a court case at Hammersmith Magistrates Court. I got my old medium format little Bronica. I walk, get there. There's a big cluster of police all stood together. Opposite, a big cluster of press all stood together and a barrier. And behind that, at EDL, I walk straight over the barrier to the first guy I see, stick out my hand. Hi, I'm Ed. Who are you? And that's what I did 8 times over 3 years. And yet when, say, Huffington Post and CNN ran it, they made a really big deal about photographer embedded 3 years. Oh, amazing. Da-da. But every time it's just that idea of negotiating access just on a personal level. And a lot of my stories, it's always done that way. Because you might have picked up here, the authority thing, I'm not such a fan of, especially bureaucracy.
Yeah,
and when you do
that.
Stories on like subcultures or fringe events or fringe people, there's not a fucking meeting. Do you know what I mean? I don't have to show my passport. I don't have to do that stuff. What I do is I walk in and it's based on trust.
Mm.
And we operate like that.
You were basically saying earlier that, you know, you think that one of your strengths is that you can sort of assimilate into any kind of different group or subculture, regardless of where they are. Why do you think you've got? Where do you think that talent comes from? Because it is, I think,
Think ultimately it's because I'm a bit of a dork. Right. I was like,
how does that help?
An isolated kid, and I grew up in my head a lot, like playing, you know, sort of role-playing games and other kinds of jazz and video games and whatever.
Right. And so you were sort of isolated.
What that does is it really makes you appreciate company.
Yeah.
And also what it means is that a lot of the things I pick, because I'm, like I said, with the research, I'm really kind of into researching. So on a way as well, it's like, not like Diane Arbus where she said, you know, people like the kind of attention I give them. A lot of the stuff I photograph, people don't want attention. And then on that level, you just have to be, and here's the key word, genuine.
Mm.
Genuine. People aren't fucking idiots, man. Even when I was in Texas, in the middle of rural Texas, I walked past a tree of dead pigs hanging from it and all kinds of weird shit, and I just keep going. It's because when I meet someone, I'm on the line, I'm on the level, and they know that.
Yeah.
Even if they're not fucking smart or whatever, or super sharp or college educated, it does not matter because, you know, yeah. People feel my enthusiasm. They feel that I'm on board. They also, once again, it's that weird thing I was saying in that, you know, I care. I really care. And when you care about stuff, I think people can just read that and they know that, you know, they're going to be okay.
So did you get to know any of these EDL guys or was it more sort of superficial than that? I mean,
on this one, not really, no, because I just dip in.
Yeah, like, you dipped in and out.
Yeah.
It wasn't like you were trying to embed yourself.
Not at all. And what I did, but just the photos alone, if you look at the work, a lot of them, because also up until this point, it was the first project I'd shot where it wasn't really on the same kind of ideological wavelength I was.
Mm.
And I wasn't sure how to tackle it. Like, I didn't want to, you know, was going to happen. So anyway, what happened was the first shots are very humorous. Shots of a woman pulling down, exposing a bum with an EDL tattoo and everyone's laughing, or another weird shit with a guy of Osama bin Laden masked by a toilet, which then ends up as like shots of like scared looking weird dudes, people screaming, and then, you know, the guy bleeding from his head. And that was the point. I've done an interview on French TV about the work, and it was, there's a lot of anger from groups, but, you know, you're going to out hate a hate group. that's not how it works, you know? And ultimately, like, my photos showed, like, the media does this wonderful thing where they get a topic and they want to try and get people terrified or pay attention because it's such a big evil. Okay, there are problems in the world, right? And there are bad things going on and there are bad people. But a bunch of guys who are a bit football hooligan-y who are, you know, going out just being fucking basically racist and crazy and polemic or whatever, like, I think there are bigger demons to defeat. I think they're basically going to defeat themselves. And they kind of did, let's be honest. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, they're gone now.
Yeah, they imploded.
That's the thing.
But I guess those people will always be out there one way or another, regardless of their sort of what they, the name of their organization.
Yeah. But the thing is now also, it's, you know, it's really about education as well. And that was something that I was big on. And
well, I mean, what was your view of those people? It wasn't particularly judgmental then. Or you try not to be judgmental. You were saying that you were more or less feeling sorry for them.
Yeah, but at the same time, like, there was fucking crazy moments, man. Like, when I was in Birmingham, they always made them meet outside a pub. So it's like two Fizing guys, all fucking, lots of them are shaven heads, quite tall, intimidating. This weird old dude comes up to me, sees my camera, and starts swearing at me, like, who the fuck are you? What the fuck? And now everyone's turning at me, and it's all getting really fucking aggro. So I just look straight back at him and say, well, who the fuck are you? I didn't see you at Nuneaton. Anyone know who this fucking clown is? And I turned it back on him. And it's like, it was horrible. It was like, you walk around basically, the police looking at you like they're EDL and they hate you. The EDL looking at you like you're like, they know, you know, you've got a camera, you're the fucking enemy because you're misrepresenting them. Because they're really a human rights movement. That's what they see themselves as. Unite Against Fascism are there. Because I'm marching along, taking photographs in the EDL, like I'm in it, they fucking hate me.
Yeah, so everyone hates you basically.
Everyone hates you.
But at least you know where you are.
You know, but then you get back and you feel like you have to have a bath and you just feel fucked up. But
how come they tolerated you? They could have easily just not tolerated you.
While I was photographing a demo of the EDL at Whitechapel, when they tried to march to Whitechapel and they only got as far as Aldgate East.
Yeah, I remember
on that day, a female journalist was sexually assaulted. A photographer was set on fire. I was walking around with a black t-shirt that said in large yellow letters, trust me, I'm a photographer. I'm going to be a bit weird now. Are you ready?
Yeah, please do.
Here we go. So a lot of fine artists will say that photojournalists, you know, it's not real because just their presence alone manipulates the scene, you know, and the way they're there and people act up for the camera or people are doing whatever. And you know what? Yeah, some people believe that. Other people believe that, you know, the photojournalist is aware of that and they're trying to keep it on a level, like trying to sort of show kind of what's actually going on. I would go on further and I'm probably capable of like manipulating the space-time continuum and influencing my will on reality. So I'm a hardliner on that level, I'd think.
Okay. You know,
I'd say the fine artists are right that, yeah, a photographer influences their reality by photographing. But I'll go out there and say, no, I literally can impose my will on like 2,000 skinheads and just walk through and keep it okay.
Well, that, you know, that view probably stood you in good stead because, you know what I mean? You can't really go into that with a faint heart, can you?
No.
Otherwise, you're not gonna be able to stick with it.
It's just about fear and belief and perception is reality, right? Here's the thing on street photography. You've got a camera, you're doing street photography. You start being a shifty bugger. You start squatting down, leaning around corners. Okay, man, someone's going to call the police, right? Because at best, you're a terrorist. At worst, you're a paedophile, yeah?
Or possibly both.
Or both. And like, then where do you stand? You're in trouble. Whereas, you walk down the street in the same situation with a high-vis jacket on, doing street photography, standing bolt upright, no one messes with you.
Yeah.
And this is, once again, it's this weird politics of experience. When I experience you, Ben, I'm not experiencing you. I'm experiencing my reflection of you. In the same way when you meet me, you're not really meeting me. You're meeting your interpretation of me.
Yeah, exactly.
And here's the horrible thing, isn't it, that you shouldn't judge a book by its cover, but people do. And if that is the case, then you can manipulate your cover to then elicit certain responses or whatever, you know, like we all do it, man. The joke that you tell to your granny is not the joke that you tell to your friends at the pub.
Yeah,
we all have these very sort of stratified versions of selves and different things. So,
yeah. Oh, I know what we should talk about. Tell me about Punctum.
Ah, okay.
Because I think that's very interesting what you're doing.
In 2013. I saw kind of a trend in the photo land of having very expensive workshops, very expensive portfolio reviews. The fact that lots of people whose job it is to be kind of leaders in the industry, tastemakers, editors, would only get accessed by people with money. I thought that was a bit crap. So, you know, because just because you're a poor photographer doesn't make you a poor photographer.
Mm.
Okay. So what I did, because I'm a bit like this, even though I started this little photo business thing with no contacts at the job center, I, by this point, had a lot of contacts. So I emailed lots of my editors that I knew and lecturers, gallerists, and I had them all come and give free portfolio reviews to loads of skint, talented photographers in a pub, which then also led to, like, I started teaching crazy free workshops, which are kind of a bit nuts and a bit weird, about perception, about reality, about little games that you can do to manipulate the way people see.
Mm.
I mean, the simplest one is, like, if I say to you, man, hey, that's a nice red t-shirt. It's weird, like, today everyone's wearing red t-shirts. And I say that now, and that's the end. But you leave the house now, you go for a walk, and suddenly I've programmed you, and you start seeing it everywhere. Now, this is a game you can play in the beginning. But what it leads to, as I said, the ability to manipulate reality. Because the whole point is you're not manipulating your reality. You're manipulating yourself. And by doing that, you change reality. Crazy.
Yeah.
Anyway, then Punkton went under the radar because in one of the portfolio reviews, I looked around and there was nothing but a sea of Mac laptops and, like, girls who've been to, like, Hong Kong for the fourth time on just a little personal project. And should they go back again? And I was thinking, fuck, like, I don't have a fucking Mac laptop. This is not the demographic I was getting, trying to get through
right.
to. You know, I'm trying to... It's weird, like, that sense of entitlement.
That's quite interesting, isn't it?
There was one kid who was like, you know, I said skint or talented. You got to be skint or talented. And then people are rocking up being like, I've just got back from Marrakesh. Maybe I should go there again. I don't know. And it's like, one guy came, he was living in a squat.
Mm.
And he was awesome. I'm so glad that he came along. But for every one of him, there was, like, another person who was, like, totally taking the piss. So I had to reboot Punkton. Because that for me wasn't working. So that's when I thought, and as I was teaching at a few universities, hell man, you know what? I strip back a degree. I keep some kick-ass lecturers. What do I actually need, man? We're in the time of digital. I'm not teaching particle physics. We do not need a Large Hadron Collider, man.
Mm.
If I have a room, a projector and students, I can teach photography. And that's what I did. So that Punkton idea of the free reviews and free experiences and free darkroom sessions, that became the school of Punkton. And now for like £100, you get taught photography for a month on Saturdays, or for a bit more, I think for £250, you work on a project. I have loads of visiting tutors come in every session, which is someone who's been teaching in mainstream HE. It's really weird because some courses I've been on, they only have a budget for like two visiting lecturers in a term. I've brought two visiting lecturers every day. I've had people Skyping in from all over the place, you know, and really good people.
That's fantastic.
It's been good. It's been good. And a photo lab has got behind giving us money for a show, and there'll be an exhibition of the students' work at Photo Month, at East London Photo Festival. So,
and do you still have to be skint or talented? if so, how does one quantify?
Well, that was in the beginning, man. That was in the beginning, just trying to make a point.
Yeah,
that
no, and it's a, I think it's a
way of trying
I think it's
to make
a good
a point,
point
that, you know. But no, people have come along so far. They've been people who have maybe studied. One guy was studying like political science and he was interested about being a journalist, wanted to brush up his skills. Another woman was a journalist wanting to brush up her photo skills. One girl was great. She lived in a boat with her boyfriend. And like she came along and other people. I mean, they're small classes. This is the other thing, man. Some of the degrees I've taught on, there are 90 students in a year. 90. Whereas with Punkton, once again, like... 10 students. There's plenty of people. You know?
That's brilliant. And I think, you know, also, it kind of, in a way, it's a great kind of halfway house. But if for people who can't decide whether to, you know, commit to a full 3-year degree or whatever, and, you know, that then costs them quite a lot of money, or go the sort of, well, I'll just go and start doing it route, you know, you've got something in between where you get a little, you know, it's not a whole 3-year commitment or even a 1-year commitment, but you can get a lot of teaching crammed into quite a short time frame. And that could in itself, you know, be enough to then give you a bit of a kickstart and then you go out and start doing it.
Well, that's what I was saying as well, is it's such an accessible medium now with digital. Like I was one of the last film photographers, go out, shoot it, develop it, contact print, maybe do a larger print, assess what you've done, look at your workings. Digital, man, it's like go out, shoot, look at the metadata. What did I do then? Learn, do more, get a great shot, be inspired, get more, you know? And I think, yeah, that's it sounds so obvious, man. You want to be a great photographer? Go be a great photographer. It's that simple. You just have to go do it. And I think, especially my experience with the very fine art photography degree, we were just talked at about panopticons and... you know, advanced semiotics and linguistical ideas and crazy shit for ages, to the point where then we'd have a project assignment, we'd spend so long theorizing an idea, we'd shoot it all in like the day before the hand in, and then, you know, the kids who had the best grades had shit work as well, but they had like a better kind of critical theory behind it. And that still goes on.
That would drive me absolutely
I'm a bit of a hardliner in that I do like conceptual photography though. But I like conceptual photography that also, if it needs to, has some serious fucking strong aesthetics. I think both can work together. Some work admittedly has no aesthetic value, and that's what it's doing, and it's still a conceptual thing, and, you know, that's fine. But for me, I believe you can put it together, you know? Great ideas, great visual, you know, hits as well. Like, it can be, you know, it can be sublime, it can be uncanny, and it can be all these wonderful, crazy things, and at the same time, still have something to say, not just be wishy-washy because the person who makes for it, you know, the person who's making it basically stands for nothing, and that's why it's hollow. Whereas you see lots of people, I'm sure in your experience interviewing, like a lot of these people doing this work, there's a whole lot going on beneath the surface. And, you know, they're trying to basically, I guess, make a difference in a way for what they do. Because if you're doing this for ego, it's not going to work, man. You know, when I said the fine arts student, there was a magazine called Portfolio. And everyone wanted to be in Portfolio. You know, that's what you wanted to do, right? Oh, I've got to be in Portfolio. Portfolio was like a freaky fine art magazine that maybe 500 people read that didn't pay you to publish your work. That is not a sustainable goal, is it?
No.
You know what I mean? It's not even a worthy goal. And that's also one thing for my career. The internet, man. The internet made my career. Because I never had like a kingmaker or a gatekeeper push me up. It was just having the work online. You know, National Geographic magazine saw my work and came to me. You know, like,
yeah, so that does work.
Yeah. And that's the wonderful thing. And this is why one of my mantras is that on a long enough timeline, all photographers are anonymous. Yeah. In 50 years and 100 years, no one's going to know who the hell you are. But you know what remains? The photographs. So make good work. Make good work. That's all you have to do. And if you make good work, there you go. It's a bit harder now in one way because there's so much stuff out there. But once again, it doesn't matter because if you're doing it once again for an ideological reason, the work is the reward. It's like Eugene Smith said, you know, the work is the reward. There you go.
What a perfect way to end it, Ed. So thanks, man. It was really interesting. I feel as though, in a way, we kind of glossed over. Not glossed over. I don't feel like I gave the unseen quite as much weight as perhaps I could have. But people can go and see the blooming work online and go to the exhibition if they're in London, if they happen to be in London. Although I think there's only a few prints, aren't there? Maybe forget about the... No, go to the exhibition, but also look at the other stuff. And you know, go to the Kickstarter page because that's where you're trying to raise the money. And you know, if you're interested, if you're into the book, then order one. You know, via Kickstarter, and you help fund the project. How do people find it? What is it? Just they look up your name, or
if
what?
If you just go to my website right now, there's like a screen grabber Kickstarter on the front page of the website. You click on that, and it takes you straight to it.
Yeah. So it's edwardthompson.co.uk. All right. Awesome. Thanks, Ed.
Cheers, Ben. Thank you.